This is Reality Proves Possibility, an exploration of human ingenuity. Wonderful. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Pearson, and I'm here with Chris Marquis from the Cambridge Judge School of Business. And it's a pleasure to be here with you on Reality Proves Possibility. We can do better than this. And Chris, thanks so much for being here. But I'd like you to just respond to Reality Proves Possibility, because I think it also describes some of the work that you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. No, thanks so much for having me. Really looking forward to our conversation, Michael. In many ways, as I've come to think about the work that I do with a lot of social entrepreneurs, smaller private sector firms, you know, people often say, like, you know, why study those firms? They're never going to make a big difference. And I think, you know, for the title of your show is actually the reason why I do think they're, you know, really important, because actually by proving that various business models around sustainability, you know, inequality, social impact, discrimination, whatever, can actually work, this actually provides case studies, examples for other companies and also for policymakers. I think this is something, you know, a lot of times policy is very disconnected from reality, so to speak. But if that's a lot of the reason why it's hard for things to pass. But actually, if there's like a tangible model that can work, I think it becomes much easier. I think, you know, some of the work I've studied around B corporations and the work they've done around defining ESG measurement, defining corporate governance legal standards, have gone on, you know, 10, 15 years later and actually been enacted in a variety of policy. And I think this is an example where something gets proven, and policymakers feel much more courageous about adopting it if they can see that it works.
Right. And your work has been like showcasing this, I think, throughout, even with the newsletter that you're bringing out weekly, which I'm just in awe of how you can do this on top of all the other things with such high quality and really like in-depth studies of organizations that are probably not on the radar for most people, even myself. I'm like, oh, wow, that's interesting. I did not know. Can you tell us a little bit about how that process works for you, how you're doing this, and maybe at some point also just give us a little bit of a glimpse of how you got to do this?
Boy, yeah, that's a lot of questions. So how I got to do this, how far back should I rewind the tape in some ways? So I think since my PhD, really, I've been interested in understanding how business can have a positive impact on society. You know, teaching at business schools, as you do, as I do, this is not always the dominant perspective, so to speak. But it always seemed to me that actually the private sector, like a commercial engine, could actually provide a lot of opportunities for positive social impact instead of detracting from the world, which I think a lot of business activity does. And so I got started. Sort of some of the work I did in my PhD involved very old style things like companies supporting nonprofits, philanthropy, which are important, certainly. But, you know, for an example, you know, of where I sort of changed to look at much more about how companies are embedding social mission in their business models is my students actually told me. So after getting my PhD, I taught for a number of years at Harvard Business School, and a traditional class on corporate social responsibility at the time. This is probably like 2008, 2009. And, you know, we were studying large companies, you know, like IBM or Goldman Sachs. I mean, companies that, you know, actually, maybe their business models are not that, you know, that good for the world, but they had pretty innovative philanthropy or social impact work. And students said to me in class one day, we had a really interesting discussion about, like, you know, why study these companies where the social mission is, you know, off to the side, innovative though it is, you know, we should really be trying to understand companies that are focused on, have a social mission at their core, and have connected their business model to social and environmental impact. And so that, you know, that actually was very influential to me and really started me off on a lot of, you know, sort of a lot of the research I've ended up doing.
Wonderful. That's a testimony to the students and the interaction with students.
Totally. I mean, I don't know how you find it in your class, but I mean, both the undergraduates and I do a lot of executive education. I mean, I think this is really where so much of the ideas that I have, my connection to the real world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's those are the, you know, that's really crucial to me. And, you know, I try to do a lot of academic research too. And I find that, you know, to really understand the mechanisms of, you know, in the academic research, you know, at least the work I do is very quantitative, and you know, you have these statistical relationships, but actually trying to unpack how and why, you know, A leads to B is not always obvious. And so all this work that I'm doing in the field through in teaching, you know, really helps me with that. So I see it a very much like a virtuous cycle. And I, you know, I write books too, which focus on a different audience, but can be used in my classes and then also help me with the academic research.
That's wonderful. And you're very prolific in your scholarship, right? And I remember, I think, reading some of your earlier work on imprinting and things like that, and community banks and things like that. That's what I recall. It's like, oh, okay. Sure. So, and then, I think we ran into each other a couple of times at Harvard Business School at the time when you were there.
Right.
And so, and it's like, okay, that's a very interesting, powerful journey. And also using the frameworks that you have and you're really skilled at sort of like using and deploying, even I think in your Profiteers book, it's like other people are commenting that, yeah, they can spot the sociologist in the way that you treat that. So I think that's a rare feat. What do you see that you learned for yourself that you may be able to give to upcoming academics, students, PhDs, or those that might be interested in sort of being influencers in that domain? Because you're like illustriously academically credentialed.
Well, that's very, very kind of you to say. You know, I think, and this is not something. I mean, I think careers may have different phases, so to speak. I do think, you know, if I were speaking to a group of PhD students or early career, you know, junior scholars, I would say really just, you know, mainly focus on your academic papers, because that is what actually can help you get tenure and have a more stable, you know, position, basically. But I do think, though, that trying as much as possible to get connected into the so-called real world is so essential. I mean, I think this is something where, you know, I think my doctoral training was incredible. I had the most amazing advisors. The time I went to University of Michigan, the time I was there, you know, I mean, it just was one of these times where, I mean, they're just amazing energy and so many great things ended up happening. So I'm very fortunate and lucky to have done that. However, I must say there was not a lot of interest or recommendations for faculty even to be engaging more broadly. And so I think this has changed, and I think it's a good thing that there's a lot more, lot more attention on, you know, having a much more of a real world type of impact. And I think it's so important, I think, because, you know, we in business schools, I think have a lot of underutilized knowledge and expertise, and in some ways tools that can help change the world in positive ways. And, you know, so much of the, I guess, sort of influential academics seem to come from economics, which I don't want to bash economists necessarily, but there's too many of them that are, you know, they're maybe having some would be useful, but, you know, every discipline comes with its own set of, you know, assumptions. And I think that the sort of the assumptions of economics have pervaded our policy and our in some ways corporate ideologies maybe a bit too much.
And while you're saying people should focus on their academic work, I think you have been able to infuse the academic work, and I think what's maybe increasingly possible because the reality exists of studying organizations that are actually doing something that people oftentimes say is actually worthwhile studying. And it's regenerating themselves as a part of being part of a conversation. I don't know how you experience that yourself, but I think you've mentioned that it's like actually fantastic to have this combination of, I would say, value-aligned research and practice.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I do think the goal is to have some sort of virtuous cycle where, the writing for general interest audiences and practitioners ends up influencing your teaching and influencing your research in a way. And I do feel very fortunate that I think I've sort of reached that, that position. And I think part of it too is that, you know, we're all on our own learning journeys. And I do think that I have a reasonable idea, unless everything changes with AI, who knows, of doing a research type of article. And so given that, I think it opens up a lot more time to do other types of writing and engagement. So for instance, I've been trying to write a lot of sort of op-ed type of pieces. And this is like the levels of rejection and difficulties and perseverance that has taken has really been a lot, and it's been a real learning journey. But I've started this when I published my first book, which was in 2020, Better Business. And now, I guess 5 years later, feel like I'm sort of starting to get some traction on things. And it's, I had things here and there, but it's been tough. It's really tough, actually. Like publishing in our journals is really tough.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm April Hardy, crime victim advocate trained by NOVA, founder of In Case I'm Murdered, and recent recipient of a $12,500 grant for intimate partner homicide prevention work. I've experienced domestic violence from both sides, as the employee whose performance suffered, and as the business owner who absorbed every cost directly. This is the Safe Work Advantage podcast that helps HR professionals and business leaders recognize risk, reduce liability, and protect their people.
Right. No, everything is a learning journey in some way. And I think that's where I'm sort of looking into what is it that we can potentially amplify? Because in some way, I think it requires community. And it's nice to have this old model of academia where you're sort of the lonely ivory tower person. But given some of the work and the needs of the world, I'm sensing really, we preach collaboration, right? But it's like, what does it mean for academia if we wanted to say, we want to influence the world about what's possible?
Yes.
And not what's impossible, right? And I think at this point, my assessment is humanity is trapped in this impossibility thinking, where it's like most of the issues that we know of, and you write about that, and you showcase that, is like, it's possible to address these issues.
Totally.
Has been done. Really, the missing link is scale. And that's collaboration at a human level. And we know a lot about collaboration, right? But how do we practice that? And I think, what's the story out there? And so that's just like an invitation for you. What are your thoughts?
I totally agree. And I do think that, you mentioned story, and I think this is so important. I mean, I do think that, I think that it's, it's not just sort of the, in some ways, sort of technical, so to speak, aspect of collaboration, but there's a huge cognitive element where I think that people are oriented in ways of, I don't want to, again, sort of blame my economist colleagues and neoliberalism, but, that sort of we have this free market system and it's, it's short-term, short-termism is what companies should be graded on. Shareholders are more important than other stakeholders, et cetera. And I think that reshaping a narrative is really what the crucial thing that needs to be done. And so, your work on film is so inspiring with that because, visual media, it's going to have a lot bigger impact than some op-ed that I have, I'm sure. Much better suited to write op-eds. I don't know much about filmmaking, but I think, I think we all need to do our own sort of parts in this, and I it's so important to think about different ways to try to change the narrative basically and have people understand that the economy is in some ways a tool for us to we should be looking for greater human flourishing but in some ways it seems people think the economy is an end in of itself and it's these anyway so
It's a human construction, and we forget the human element, right? And that human agency, I think that's where the possibility lies. And whenever we see that, and I just want to like hear from you, how are you able to collect all these examples, like in your newsletter? It's not just a newsletter. It's really like a fundamental resource. I'm curious personally how you're able to put that together. But how do you collect these ideas and maybe share one or two highlights really that give you hope, grounded hope in terms of like, yeah, we can do this.
Yeah. So like the newsletter is about having tons of Google, whatever those things are called, the automatic emails
that you
you know, 100 different topics. And then if I'm interested in doing, let's say a newsletter, you know, I have something coming up, you just published on Saturday on design. And so we can search, you know, what are, you know, the examples that come up around design. So that's, you know, sort of a broad sort of scanning, you know, type of thing. And, you know, I do this both, I do Forbes articles, as well as the newsletter as a way to try to help me find future research opportunities in some ways. And so part of it is, you know, sort of myself, sort of productizing my research process in some ways. So, you had a second question.
Yeah, no, from that work that you're doing there, what sticks out for you as sort of like some of the key stories or that give you hope?
I mean, I'm trying to think of ones that like so many of them are overplayed, and overplayed is not the right way because they do amazing things and I don't want to, like the one thing, I mean, I know you've done a film on Grayson.
Yeah.
The reason I like that example, because open hiring is such a sort of cognitively different way to conduct sort of, you know, sort of intaking people into your business. And that's an example where we need to shift cognitive frames and think of ways. And I know they have a foundation where they're trying to spread that model. And I've talked to Joe Kenneth, I'm sure you must know him by now, you know, like trying to get out and talk to people about this, it can be a challenge because it just is so different from the way, you know, we conduct HR. But actually, if you unpeel how sort of HR and hiring is conducted, there's all these biases that are baked into it. And really, it's just some historical path-dependent process that, you know, we accept as like the right way to do things, but actually for certain types of jobs. And if you want to be fair in hiring, having a situation like open hiring where people just sign their name on a list and, you know, when they get down to your name, they bring you in. I mean, so that's like an example that I find really powerful in so many ways, but your listeners probably know a lot about that.
Yeah, now but it is a great example of what, if you have a different perspective on human beings, wow, what is possible, right? Like cutting through these path dependencies by not knowing and just
using a
frame. It's like, wow, it's possible. And it's cheaper.
Right. And just as if not more effective. And, you know, so there's a lot of companies that are, you know, have like Rhino Bakery, Rhino Foods, which you might know of. It's in Vermont. They are doing a bunch of similar types of things around, you know, sort of no interest, no question loans to employees. You know, the thing that I find, and I am going to probably the way I say this belie my own sort of ignorance, but really interfacing with these businesses like Grayston, Rhino Foods, there's another one, Cascade Engineering, which is in Michigan. I think Fred Keller attended the event that you had recently. They, you know, the experience of those entrepreneurs in seeing their workforce that they obviously care a lot about, that the situation in the United States for people with low economic resources, I mean, is so fundamentally challenging because of how our systems are set up. And if you have like one little thing go wrong, it sort of cascades into some, you know, huge giant disaster. And so, So businesses that actually sort of recognize that and try to then create ways for to really foster growth for their employees is I think, you know, super important.
Now, I think newsletter and the framing that you're also using in terms of regeneration, regenerative, like, is there something in the space? Because I always just fascinated by the other examples. What do you see is, like, let's say we would make another film, we had budget. What would be worthy telling a story about that's not just a fluke, right? It's not just like, oh, a nice little thing.
Yeah. So let me say, a couple things about regeneration. This is a word that lots of people use. Some people use it, I think, very appropriately. I think it's a kind of a buzzword at times now. And what I think, my sort of, I guess, somewhat definition and conceptualization of it is really around positive externalities, very, very simply. So much of sustainability is about doing less harm, mitigating damage. Whereas if we think regeneratively, it's about actually creating the mechanisms for business to have a net positive effect on humans, community, the natural environment, et cetera. So this is most sort of developed in areas of agriculture. And there are a lot of companies that are doing really fascinating and important things. Large ones like Natura. You might know Natura.
Yeah. We actually have a film in production about them.
Oh, great. Good. So I took students this past year to Sao Paulo and got to spend some time with the folks.
I think we were there just a week.
Oh, yeah. We were there. That's right. So funny. As you know, one of your colleagues was leading a student trip from Fordham, and I sort of ran into her, and she said, yeah, I guess you had gotten on the bus, I think.
Okay. Oh, yes.
We ran into each other in we're staying in the same hotel, in the lounge, it's so funny. We just sort of started talking to each other. It turned out she was leading this trip from Fordham and just finishing, and I was just starting. Yeah, so Natura, is one example, and that I've done a variety of work with. I think smaller ones, I think there's some coffee companies, Ely Coffee also. And this is an example. I recently interviewed, I think he's the head of sustainability for one region. If you ever want to talk to him, I can get you his name. But he told me about how actually for the longest time, Brazilian coffee has had a very bad reputation in the coffee market, I guess because of, the soil there is not as well suited, and maybe then sort of how the beans get grown. However, a number of years ago started a sort of a regenerative agriculture program in the Brazilian farms or coffee plantations that they have. And this totally revolutionized the production. And now this Brazilian coffee has won a number of international awards because of this. So this is, the example. And if you think about, regenerative agriculture, it sounds very fancy, but basically it is agriculture that was, basically done for most of human history before we had this crazy industrial agriculture where, had these big giant, sort of agricultural plants. And, it's funny, sort of like you have all the sort of cows and animals and, in one place, and you have all the growing crops in another place when you used to actually have sort of animals and food production together, it actually was able to create a much more sort of effective and
symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, right.
So that's Ely, right? And Ely, coffee, right? And so
Ely coffee. They're pretty big too.
Yeah.
There's a great example also of a smaller company, LA-based apparel company. It's called, they have a brand called TerraThread, but it's Gallant is the name of the company. They have this incredible entrepreneur named Vic Geary. I think he's actually from Nepal, although it has developed very deep relationships now in India. And he has done incredible work introducing like regenerative cotton to India. And this is, there's huge amounts of scandals and challenges with organic cotton.
Right.
And to listen and hear the story about, the deep relationships that he's built with farms in India and is able to actually have a lot of, both sort of obviously upgrade, upskill, up, you know, sort of, you know, increase the income and the living standard of these farmers, and then also, you know, develop a lot of great products. Actually, I think I'm wearing one of their t-shirts now.
Oh, okay. That's great. So, but that's a LA-based company, but yeah. Supplying through India and shifting.
Buying through India, and I think they're producing them also in India. And
fantastic. Okay, so this is just interesting to see how almost every foundational good that we have in terms of food, clothing, right, shelter, all of these things were produced in a regenerative fashion at some point, and now we're getting back to that design, right, intelligence, right? And it's always been possible, but we're still in this doom kind of loop where I don't, yes, know how you experience your students, but I'm sometimes just shocked by how little hope my young undergraduates, yeah, have.
Yeah, I don't engage. I don't. I'm mostly teaching MBAs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, a lot of them, I think, are very thoughtful, but some of them, I think, are really, yeah, very cynical and dark about any potential for sustainability, and so yeah, it can be a challenge.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sarah Beth Herman, a 5-time CEO and host of the podcast No Silver Spoons. This show is for leaders, entrepreneurs, and people building something meaningful without shortcuts. We talk about leadership, mindset, business growth, and the real lessons that come from doing hard things really well. And if you're in the dental industry, you'll hear a few episodes that speak directly to that world too. Because no matter your field, leadership is leadership. Listen to No Silver Spoons wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, and I don't know how you deal with that yourself, because it's easy to, yeah, fall into that, right? And it's like, oh my God.
It is, but it's so important. So I have to, you know, worked so hard to try to increase the sustainability, required sustainability content.
Mm-hmm.
For our MBAs, and have made a little bit of progress. Mm-hmm. But you know, one thing that is concerning to me, that so much of our discussions are people like me talking to you, which I, right, enjoy talking to you, but I mean, mm-hmm, we need to talk to a lot of other people as well, right, which is why I think film is really, yeah, you know, important. It's why I really want to be teaching required classes in MBAs, mm-hmm, because even, mm-hmm, though my ratings are not nearly as good as when I do a elective class,
yeah,
and I get some sort of nasty comments, but it's really, I mean, this, you know, this is preaching outside the choir, so to speak, is so important. Yeah. And it's why I write books and try to do, mm-hmm, these various op-eds, is because I'm trying to engage with audiences beyond just the traditional sort of sustainability people, which is, I think, an easy thing to fall into, because there are a lot of amazing work and a lot of amazing people. But I think this idea of going from, I forget what, from sort of the realities to the possible, is about getting out of our bubbles and being able to communicate to wider audiences about sort of how this works and how this can work and why it's so important.
Well, so I mean, I'd be happy to just have offline more conversations of how this can be, yes, done better, or how, yeah, we can connect on that, and also just see, because I think we're all sort of dabbling with this, and we're seeing the same, right, same issue. And I think it's, for me, it's been helpful to just keep doing and trying something, because otherwise I'll fall in the, right, same cynicism, right? And it's like, I need this kind of conversation to stay sane and grounded.
Right.
Yes, truly, it can't just stay there, and it can't be anymore. I think in like 10 years ago or 20 years ago, it's a nice conversation we can have, and it can stay outside. But right now, this is really like, we're called to be change agents ourselves, however uncomfortable this is, right? And finding these approaches to new audiences, even just understanding how we can teach our standard MBA folks or anybody else, it's just like, I'm oftentimes not clear what's missing, right? But film may be an access point, op-eds may be an access point.
Yeah.
Allying with other people from that space, because correct me if I'm wrong, but I think every time when you actually get through to people, as a person, as a human being, they would not love nothing more than contribute positively to the world. And
sure, yeah.
And that doesn't matter where they're from, political spectrum they're on, or something. It's like, that's a deep desire that I'm only uncovering right now, because it's sort of like, wow, my God, like, why are we so off? And I think everybody is sort of in the space like, we're doomed. And Otto Sharma says, it's like, yeah, this is the biggest problem. It's not that we can't solve the issues that we're facing. The problem is that we don't think we can.
Right. No, I think that's totally on target. Yeah.
So anyway, any other ideas or any other things that give you hope in terms of reality proving possibility? Because those intellectual transformations have happened, right? Neoliberalism was designed.
Yeah.
They created that.
This is the thing. I mean, people think that it's somehow, you know, I don't know, some sort of natural way of doing things. I mean, you've probably read some of these histories. I mean, this is a very conscious effort by very self-interested actors to shape, shape the world in a way that benefits them. And we now think this is not you and I, but like, I think the majority of people in the world think that this is the natural way that business should operate and market should operate. And it's just insanity, really.
Yeah. And it's a psychopathic model that's actually designed to fail. That's and that's what it does, right? And I think the more people get present to that, it's like, oh, okay, here's an opportunity to showcase something else. And as Bucky Fuller, I think, said, never fight the existing system, just create a new one that's better.
Right, exactly. That's, yeah.
So, and that's where I applaud you for your storytelling in the books, because I've been able to just tell students, read this, read that. And you make a super compelling case in Profiteers, and I really applaud your audacity in some way also to use your intellectual tools in terms of speaking truth to something that we all feel, I think. But can you tell us a little bit about that process? Because writing a book is a deeply personal process, right? Anything you can share?
Sure. I mean, so, I've really come to enjoy writing books. I mean, I think that you're able to, I guess, have a voice that in a lot of our other writing, it's much more constrained. You know, sort of academic articles obviously are very constrained by, you know, the literature and the reviewers and basically being able to fit yourself into some conversation that's ongoing so that people find it interesting. Even op-eds, I mean, it's really tight words that whereas a book, I mean, you can actually make a broader argument. It's a challenge. I found it to be a real intellectual challenge, because those other things that you can sort of keep the whole story in your mind, whereas the book, you know, actually I cannot keep a whole book in my mind. So like, you know, I have a vague idea of what's at the end when I'm sort of rewriting the beginning, but I have to go through things, you know, many, many times. And so,
So it's a freeing process almost, right?
Very freeing, very freeing. Yeah. And I think, and I appreciate you saying I mentioned courageous or something. I think, you know, the critical stance, I think, is that what you were referring? Yeah.
Yeah. Also the clarity in your communication. Yeah. And it's not just like, trying to sort of like bring some platitudes in, but really giving sort of a rigorous analysis where it's like, you know, you are saying something that most people believe, but they can't put it in words because they may not have the rigor or the skills or the quantitative data behind it, right? And it's like, oh, okay, these companies are just profiteering. So, I mean, I'm just like looking at that, because in the end, I think the academic process to me has actually been dampening, get rid of this courageous voice.
Totally, totally, yeah. And I think you get sort of, I don't know, you know, not beaten down a bit, and just you're much more used to, you know, taking a easy line in our teaching. You know, people want positive case studies. So yeah, I mean, the book came about, I mean, it's interesting, because I think that the inspiration for the book actually came from a positive case study. It came from a company, Grove Collaborative, which I don't know if you know, but they're California based in Northern California, and they sort of produce, market, and sell a bunch of like health and beauty and cleaning type products. And so a lot of their products are liquids. So they need to be packaged in something like plastic, which, you know, so because they're liquid. And so the co-founder told me one time that their social mission was focused on eliminating plastic, because that was the biggest externality of the business. Mm-hmm. And this really struck me, because so much of the thinking, and I think the framing around stakeholder management, is, it's like sort of a, think about all the positive things you can do. That's what can you do for your employees? Mm. What can you do for your, you know, for your communities, et cetera. But actually thinking about like, what is the harm that is coming from your business and how, you know, how can we be as responsible for that as possible was a different way of looking at things than I had thought about and had been thinking about. And that sort of got me thinking about, okay, how can we think much more deeply about having businesses be accountable for their negative impacts on the world? And then when you start to sort of unspool that thread, you realize like all the misinformation and PR and lobbying that occurs so that, you know, not only don't even we think about account, you know, holding these businesses accountable, because we didn't even think about these are things that these are not even like cognitively on the plate, so to speak. So anyway, so that was sort of in some ways how my thinking evolved around that. And yeah.
How did you get in touch with them? Through the other book prior, The Better Business?
Through my other book, yeah. So like the Forbes articles that I've been doing now, I mean, I've over 300 of them since 2020. They basically are the way that I sort of am learning. And so, so I forget, like people recommended me them. I get all kinds of recommendations all the time. Today, just like an hour ago, there's some coffee company in Chicago called Metric Coffee. I don't know much about them, but someone that I sort of know and trust said, you know, you should really talk to this company and introduce me to the founder. And, you know, in a couple of weeks, we'll be having a phone call. So that was how I got in touch with Grove Collaborative. Mm. And I mean, these are all relationships I built up. I mean, they've gone through, they now are a new CEO who I've also gotten to know. I know a variety of the people that work there. So it's been, yeah. So these have been great relationships that I've developed over time too.
That's fantastic. And maybe just like to pinpoint that's actually a virtuous cycle in terms of what an academic, what the kind of research platform, the storytelling can be, because in the end, that's where you harvest ideas. That's where you generate and co-create ideas, right? And I think that's beautiful to hear. And I think I remember your presentation about the Pasteur's quadrant and stuff like that. And it's like, okay, you know what? What if we were actually using the academic power much more intentionally around this? Rather than have it sequentially sort of like you're the apprentice. Well, apprentice in that space and maybe put out some of that work in multiple outlets. Because, I think that's what I hear from practitioners. That's what they want. That's what they would need. And they would love to hear more of these examples that you're just describing. It's like, wow, that's fantastic that people are in that space, right? And in that conversation. And so I thank you so much for just like sharing that and also the process behind it. And I'd love to continue because I have already many ideas of what's possible.
Yeah, we should talk more, Michael, I think.
Yeah. And when you're here, we'll meet. Okay.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
So that's fantastic. But let me end with just the Proust questionnaire and maybe just a number from 1 to 35, and I'll just.
I'm supposed to pick 1 to 35?
1 to 35.
I guess 21.
21. Let me see. 21. Where would you most like to live?
I think New York City, actually.
Oh, really?
Honestly enough. Yeah. Yeah. I've lived a lot of places. I mean, I've spent, you know, over 3 years, about 3.5 years in China. There's a couple of cities there. Western China, Chengdu is a city that I really love a lot. Boston.
That's where the pandas are, right?
Yeah, the pandas are there. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But it's very relaxed and I have a lot of friends there. Boston is another place. But I think, you know, I when I was at Cornell, I was doing a lot of teaching on the Roosevelt Island campus, and I ended up locating in New York City. And, you know, I was, I don't know, about 50 or so or something at the time. And I'm like, damn, why did I not do this earlier in my life? Because, I mean, there are just so much going on. It's people, so many people are coming through. Just today, I was emailing with someone who, you know, is coming through New York, and I'm going to be there at the time. We're going to be able to meet up. And so I think it's such a vibrant, engaging place that, yeah, I think it's, and it's, so it's a place I live now, really. I mean, I'm in Cambridge for quite a lot of the year also. I mean, most of the year I'm in Cambridge, but I still have my place in New York and I'm there quite a bit.
Okay, great. Well, fantastic. So we'll definitely meet up.
Yeah, good.
And I thank you so much for the time. This was just great and inspirational. And yeah, let's figure out how we can speak to more broader audiences, also through the initiative that we're doing with the Club of Rome, where it's like, okay, we want to sort of bring that to a number of other system actors, right? Because this is, I think, a human issue.
Definitely. And I think the platform, the Club of Rome, is really important too. I mean, obviously, going back to the limits of growth, I think is really a foundational piece in this conversation. So
yeah, fantastic. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Chris. To be continued.
Super.
Thank you. Take care.